and the first bill that we're going to hear today is House Bill 2254. Bill Willard and Bruce Bishop. There you are. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Did Bill check the House?
Yes, if you would please do a quick review.
Thanks, Senator. House Bill 2254, we did hear previously on the 12th of April. It does modify the definition of child care facility. At that time, the committee was asked to postpone any action until there were amendments to include psychiatric intensive day treatment programs. Those are the dash one amendments in your packet. What the bill does is modify it. It maintains the same action as the current bill. I did run this by the Employment Division child care people, and they approve of the language in the amendments, but it does extend the definition to include psychiatric intensive day treatment, and I will defer to our presenters to discuss those amendments. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Treatment Centers. Okay. OATS is an association of psychiatric day treatment centers from across the state. With me this afternoon is Bill Willard. Bill is the executive director of the Child Center in Springfield and the president of the Oregon Association of Treatment Centers. We appreciate your hearing this bill and its amendments, and what it will do is to make a small but positive step to help day treatment programs keep the costs of liability insurance coverage down. Small community-based nonprofit programs, liability insurance is a cost of doing business for them, and this bill will give them an alternative that they can look to try to negotiate lower rates. And Mr. Willard is available if you have any questions or to learn anything more about day treatment.
Bill, did you want to introduce yourself?
Sure, that'd be good. Excuse me. Senator Morissette, members of the committee, my name for the record is Bill Willard, and as Bruce indicated, I'm the current executive director of the Child Center, a psychiatric day treatment program located in Springfield, Oregon, and the current president of the Oregon Association of Treatment Centers, and we're here to testify in favor of House Bill 2254 and the amendments as indicated. Again, it isn't going to provide us any immediate relief, but it does provide us the option of the possibility of leveraging a lower cost of liability insurance. This year alone, my liability insurance for the program I run is going to run me almost $23,000, and that's a major expense for these small programs, and it's something that if we can have any kind of leverage to go out and hopefully get a price cut or reduced cut, any little bit helps. We haven't had a cost of living increase in almost 4 years. We suffered a fairly major cut back in February of 2003, and so things are tight, to say the least, as you well know. And so any little bit helps. And so, again, we're here to support this House bill and amendments.
Okay. Good. Mr. Questions? Yes.
Yes. Sorry, not necessarily for you, but if you would look on page one, and I'm sorry I didn't bring this to your attention earlier, but line 18, it says a child care facility as defined in ORS 657A-250. And I looked up ORS 657A-250, and it is repealed. And so is that going to make any difference to you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, it doesn't make any difference to us.
Will it make any difference to what is, do we need to have a child care facility, a definition of child care facility?
We are licensed as such through Children's and Family Network, the Office of SCF, as a child care facility. We're a psychiatric day treatment, but for that side of our licensing. So whatever definition they use, we meet.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, I believe that psychiatric day treatment is covered under line 11 through 17. Those are child caring agencies under ORS 418. I believe, although I don't have it in front of me, that line 18, which you pointed out, is the Employment Department Child care facilities.
Definition. And is that something that we wanted to cover, those child care facilities under the employment? It would be nice for me to get Polly on the phone.
Chair Marcet, Senator Montesanderson, just before today, in fact, I did fax the amendments off to the Employment Division, who oversees the Child Care Division, to vet this through them. They approved of the amendments as they are.
It's just that they may not have known that ORS 657A-.250 has been repealed, and I guess there may be some child care facilities that aren't going to be covered. I think yours are going to be covered, and these others, private child care agency, and the nonprofit.
We will recess for just a minute and let the record show that Senator Montesanderson does her homework. Okay, we will resume our testimony on House Bill 2254. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I would prefer that we move into work session and pass this out before we find something else.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here.
Okay, we will close public hearing on House Bill 2254 and open a work session on House Bill 2254.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to House Bill 2254.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to House Bill 2254. -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move. Were you okay with that?
I'm okay.
Okay, fine. Okay, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2254 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
House Bill, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2254 to the floor with the, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll? Discussion. No discussion. Call the roll, please.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Excuse.
Senator Montesanderson?
Aye.
Senator Charles Starr?
Excuse.
Chair Morgan?
Aye. House Bill 2254 has passed. Would you like to carry the bill?
Sure.
Good.
Good luck here.
And if I raise that question on the floor, you
better not.
Well, I definitely will.
Thank you very much. We close the work session on House Bill 2254 and open a work session on Senate Bill 772. And we will call. Oh, yes. Would you please explain the amendment, please? And then we will.
Thank you, Chair.
Start calling testimony.
We have heard this bill two times previously. You have in your packet the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 772, including a kind of a bulleted summary attached to your staff measure summary. For brevity's sake, I will just highlight the sections that were added to the amendments and note those that are still from the original bill. In the amendments, sections 1, 2, and 3 are added to this bill. Basically, Section 1 establishes that delivery does not include transfer of marijuana by a cardholder and defines a marijuana grow site. Section 2 basically eliminates the affirmative defense, which means that a person, the legal possession of marijuana in excess of legal amount, and then defines a seedling marijuana plant allows a cardholder to possess any number of seedlings. And then Section 3 does establish that a person responsible for medical marijuana grow site for registered cardholders is accepted from criminal law for possession of marijuana and requires the Department of Human Services to issue a registry card. So, again, Sections 2, 3, and 2 to 5 are still in the original bill and are included in the amendments. The amendments then add Sections 8 through 12. Generally, Section 8... requires that DHS establish a marijuana grow site registration system that includes location of the site, that this registration card be displayed at the grow site at all times, and that requires the grow site card be obtained and displayed for each cardholder for whom the marijuana is being grown. So a grow site operator would have to have that card displayed at the site. Section 9 does allow the cardholder or caregiver to possess up to 6 mature plants and 60 ounces of usable marijuana. It does allow the grow site operator to produce marijuana for up to 4 cardholders per year. Again, does note that the card must be displayed for each registered cardholder at the site, so it had to be at least 4 cards there if they're serving 4 people. And then it allows the cardholder, caregiver, or grower to possess seedlings as defined by the Department of Human Services. In Section 10, it does clarify attending positions. Section 11 eliminates provision that allows certain individuals to assert the affirmative defense, but then does include the defense of choice of evils for certain people who are in possession of medical marijuana. Based on Section 12, establishes that a person is subject to state criminal laws for growing marijuana on a site other than authorized by the bill. And then the rest of the bill does. Still includes the last section of the original bill that creates a task force or kind of an advisory panel. That's it, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Craig Dermott and Katie Severe, please come forward.
Good afternoon, Senator Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Katie Suver. I'm a deputy district attorney in Marion County. I'm present this afternoon, however, on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The Oregon District Attorneys Association has previously submitted written testimony regarding Senate Bill 772, both in its original form and as amended. Mm-hmm. And we would ask the court, or excuse me, the court, I'm so accustomed to being in court. My apologies. We would ask the committee members to review that. And primarily our concerns with the Dash 3 amendments have to do with the fact that the Dash 3 amendments do not address our concerns regarding the unlimited amount of seedlings. That is creating a new classification of plant wherein a grower can possess an unlimited number of seedlings. This is a situation that we believe could create considerable problems for law enforcement as well as prosecution of those individuals who may actually actually be abusing the medical marijuana statute. In addition, our concerns have to do with the amounts that are indicated in the Dash 3 amendments. Obviously, up to 4 pounds of marijuana as well as 6 mature plants. It is our position that this effectively creates a blueprint for drug trafficking in this state. The original form of the bill allowed for 1 grow cycle per year with those increased amounts. In the Dash 3 amendments, it is contemplated certainly that individuals could have as many as 3 or 4 grow cycles per year, and it could grow for as many as 4 people. And obviously, if we compound that over a year's time, we're talking about one individual grower being in possession of over 60 pounds in a year of marijuana. And obviously, given the possibility even that certain people would abuse this statute and use it as a means of trafficking in controlled substances, that is our primary concern. We had previously, through written testimony, requested that the court, that the committee consider provisions regarding allowing inspections by law enforcement. That's another concern, that it is not within the Dash 3 amendments, the inspection by law enforcement. And I will defer to Mr. Durbin regarding the other concerns, but I will reiterate that as amended with these Dash 3 amendments, the ODAA would not support the bill in its present form. We are obviously open to discussion. We appreciate the committee's continued discussion on this topic, and particularly the consideration of deleting the affirmative defense, which has created a significant number of problems for law enforcement and for certain prosecutors' offices around the state. So we are certainly open to continuing this discussion, but as written, we would not agree or support the Dash 3 amendment. Thank you very much.
Senator Cruz.
We wrestled with the inspection thing for quite a while as to who should do it, how it should be done. Clearly, the health department has restaurant inspectors. We didn't think they'd be appropriate. it's a slightly different thing. And I guess, from my perspective, there are some, we aren't going to solve everything first blush in this thing. So I guess we were looking at, number one, there's going to be a registry. And I think we're intentionally silent on this, but kind of assuming, at least for the time being, that that if inspections are complaint driven, then it's going to be a matter of probable cause to be able to do the inspection, just simply because we were wrestling with how we create another system to do that, and how we would connect the health department and law enforcement and the jurisdictional issues around that. So, clearly there have been some sites in the southern part of the state that have probably been one would consider to be dangerous for somebody from the health department just to go in on their own sort of thing. So I guess that's kind of, Senator, I think that's kind of where we're coming down on this. And it was just, I mean, there is a process now, complaint-driven, for the police to go in, like I say, I'm not sure we solve all the problems this time around, but that's kind of where we were leaving it. If you have other alternatives, we'd be more than interested in hearing what they are, but it's a tough matrix to try to develop here, I think. So.
Thank you, Senator Cruz, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. If I can just briefly respond to that, I understand the concerns, and I know previously we have discussed that very concern. Sending folks who are not trained law enforcement officers to do inspections can indeed be dangerous, because if they're going out to do inspections, it's usually because there is information that someone is out of compliance. If they're out of compliance, they may very well be engaging in criminal conduct. And that's dangerous not only for trained police officers, it's dangerous for everybody. However, I do believe that if we continue this discussion, there will be a way for us to fashion an ability to inspect. Maybe it's not a probable cause standard, and maybe it's not directed by employees of DHS. But it is something that I think if we are discussing increasing the amounts of medical marijuana that a grower can actually grow in order to ensure that the program itself is remaining the integrity that I know many of the people within the program want to maintain. We need to be able to trust our law enforcement officials and trust those individuals who are involved in the program to work collaboratively and go through with those inspections. So I can't say that I have the magic answer, but it's certainly something that I think warrants further discussion.
Can I just follow, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You know, I mean, at one point we're looking at, just kind of a lottery. DHS says, go inspect these five this year. You know, just kind of a knock on the door sort of thing. And you know, there may be some validity to that. And you know, people that are doing this right aren't going to be upset about something like that, I wouldn't think.
Yes, they are.
Okay, please. Depends on who's doing the inspection, ma'am. You know,
okay.
But you know, as you can see, we run into some issues here, and you know, I would like to be able to solve this riddle. I guess at this point in time, there is a way now. If there is complaints or if there is suspicion for law enforcement to go, if they can establish probable cause, they can get a search warrant. You know, that's in the law now. I guess what I don't want to do, if we can't resolve all issues, is stop some things from going forward. Is basically where I'm at this point in time. This is important stuff that we at least move portions of this and not wait till we have solved all the problems before we do anything. So
we're not going to move this bill today, first of all, because there are some problems that in fact it's been said that any difficult bill worth its salt should have at least 10 amendments. We've only got 3 so far. So. But I'm hoping, though, that we will move something, and I have permission from the president to continue a work. The committee will otherwise shut down today, but we will continue this, and we're going to try to correct some of the things. Now, the question that I have is, what we tried to do is accommodate the patient by delivering the medicine to the patient and not leave it with the grower. So the grower should not have an accumulation that, as it is ready, that should be delivered to the patient for the patient's use, because it is the patient's property. So theoretically, there should be no usable marijuana on the site of the grower. It should be, when it's ready, it should be delivered. Now, do you have a problem with the patient having up to 60 ounces?
I'm going to go ahead and defer to Mr. Gerben on that one.
Yeah. Chair Morsa, members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I'm a lieutenant with Oregon State Police and with the Drug Enforcement Section. I think somehow we got to the figure of the 60 ounces when we first, in the very first draft, we looked at the one grow per year and that how much marijuana did the patients need for that given year if they were just to grow one cycle and have everything on site. I think that's somehow we got to that 60 ounces. Okay. And I'm a visual learner. I actually had my staff put this together because this kind of gives an idea. If you're looking at this would be on site currently with 60 ounces.
Would you stand up and come over to the side so everyone has a chance to see what you're doing? Pardon me? We will need that for an exhibit, so you'll have to. And I guess you're going to have to talk very loudly into that microphone.
I can talk loudly.
Okay,
but if you're looking at this, one of the issues that we've talked about before is that, and I was talking with Mr. Berger just before this, is that a lot of this is so arbitrary because depending on the THC level, you can have anywhere from 2% THC on up to, I seized as a task force, 33% THC.
That's uncommon. Granted, we're probably somewhere around 12, 13. But THC levels are arbitrary. So depending on THC level, you may need one marijuana joint. You may need two or three. But and how you roll it, depending on your element, depending on all those issues. So it's very arbitrary. But if you look at 60 ounces, 3.75 pounds, and then you use single rolling papers, you're going to end up with 5,100 marijuana cigarettes, which is, if we take on a growth cycle, they're talking about needing, if I harvested my plants for 4 months that I need before the next growth cycle, how much would I need? You're talking about 42 cigarettes per day to use it up that amount in 4 months. But if I rolled it as a gram each, it still comes out to 14 cigarettes per day. So you're talking 14 a day, you would basically have to smoke one gram every hour that you're awake.
Okay. Let me rephrase my question then.
I'll get to it.
Okay. We dropped the idea of doing an annual grow in this scenario, the dash threes, and so we're looking at a cyclical grow with the mature marijuana being delivered to the patient and not being kept on site. Now, is that still a cause for concern? Because you said you would have a grower growing for four patients with all of the plants and all of the mature marijuana, but there should not be any mature marijuana. When it's ready to use, it should be out of there. Do you have a problem with the patient having control of, and I guess we had a difficult time coming, knowing how many ounces that would be at a time to be delivered. And I don't, if you're going to do that, there has to be some leeway built into that. And so anyway, how do you respond?
Chairman Morris and members of the committee, we still, again, because it's arbitrary, it is difficult based on THC levels, ailments, the amount that you need to relieve the pain, all those type of things. So we as law enforcement are looking at, we do not believe that you can have this huge jump from where we're at currently of an ounce per plant. If you look at, and I believe Stormy Ray Foundation is going to testify here, and that's kind of what we're going on, is that seven plants, 3 ounces per plant. Now, she says that that's enough to get her, if she was to harvest all the plants, that 3 ounces per plant would get her to the next harvest. So that's the Stormy Ray. I realize there's other advocates here that disagree with that. But I'm thinking, I just can say that from law enforcement's perspective, for us to get to 3 ounces is a stretch. If we're going to go beyond that, I do not believe that unless somebody, there's nothing scientifically that says exactly this is the amount you need. Right now, as far as it's all subjective and there's no real objective test, I believe that, you know, we're not going to get much beyond 5 ounces per plant, you know, that you have as you harvest. And then it would be one of those very clear, bright lines. If you have a plant that's harvested, let's say if we're going to set seven mature plants, you have a plant that's harvested, therefore you should have 3 ounces on hand. If you have two plants that is harvested, you should have 6 ounces on hand. So it'd be 3 ounces per harvested plant.
On hand.
On hand. And so then you would, and then at the same level, this, the other issue with law enforcement that we have with the amendments is the unlimited amount of seedlings. Because currently you could have 1,000 seedlings. And realize that's a very, you know, that's an exaggeration, but you could have, and there is no control over that. So I think there should be a very specific number of plants mature, very specific number of ounces per plant harvested, and a very specific number of seedlings. And we're just, our feelings are is that we like what the Stormy Ray Foundation is putting forward, that seven plants, 3 ounces per harvested plants, three seedlings per plant. Now the argument is, well, we need a lot of seedlings to look at what we can find a female Well, if you have 21 seedlings sitting there and I'm going to harvest a plant, I should be able to find a female within those 21 seedlings. If I can't, there's provisions within this program of the sharing. And I know other people that are growing and have seedlings that I could find a female plant. So in the provisions of the numbers, I think we do need those very clear guidelines. And I think that I would like to see something move forward so that we can get some of these things cleared up. And I believe that the inspections as well, we'll have to get there eventually, and we probably will not get there this time. But in this area with plants, we could have very clear guidelines. If we also could have, and we talked about this, and this is one thing that's missing from this, is that if we're not going to have inspections, we do need to have severe repercussions for those caregivers, for those growers that want to distribute or manufacture that are convicted. And therefore, we really set, you're not going to come to Oregon and disestablish a grow just so that you can grow and later on distribute. That if you do, you're not going to be in the program. And those are the big issues for us now. The plant numbers coming down, the amount that you can have on hand per harvested plant, the repercussions for the cardholder, for the caregivers and the growers if they're convicted. And then also, the other issue, the main issue is that if I'm in possession and I'm outside of my grow site location, I have to have something on my person that says I'm allowed to be in possession so that we do not have these tort claims happening with law enforcement, and we are not taking this marijuana from these people as they're out in their activities.
Question.
I understand there's some concerns with definitions. We were trying to separate caregivers from growers because, quite simply, caregiver, as it is in statute now, is fairly defined function. And a lot of these patients do have caregivers, take care of daily needs and that sort of thing, which we thought should be differentiated from a grower, although theoretically it could be the same person, but there's function here and function here, and what we weren't wanting to do was blend this thing, because caregiver is a term in law that covers a lot more areas than just this. But you had some problems with us setting up three different categories, right? Could you kind of
Chair Morris, Senator Cruz, this is one that we're still struggling with, because yes, we do. I guess the main problem that we have in law enforcement, and I believe with ODAA, is that we haven't seen a generated need, that there's been a shortage of caregivers or a problem with the program right now, that if you have a patient that is so debilitated that they need someone to grow for them, that the caregiver cannot do that for them. So then to expand beyond and add another classification that you're going to have to deal with, somebody else that you're going to have to deal with in another classification, that's an issue and a problem for us. I think it's semantics and the caregiver grower, because in the program right now, the patients look at the caregiver as the grower. So they look beyond just somebody that's administering their marijuana to them or assisting them in their needs throughout the day and that type of thing. They look at the caregiver as the grower. And I know that there's quite a majority of them as well that do not believe that they want to expand into another realm beyond caregiver. I don't know how you answer that. I think that if you want to go to the place that you're looking at going, maybe you do something in that a caregiver is someone who helps administer the marijuana to them, but then if the caregiver is to grow, they also register as a grower. So then you have a clear separation. So a caregiver is just an administrator, an aide, those type of things, but they're not necessarily a grower.
Okay. The reason that we tried to differentiate is to simplify, actually, is that the person who is growing is the grower. And that is a clear, bright line, we thought, between the patient who may need a medical caregiver to assist them. Now, I guess the confusion can come in is the medical caregiver could also, perhaps, in some cases, serve as a grower on site with the patient. maybe the problem is that we've used caregiver for the grower since the beginning of the program, and it would take a while to differentiate, but that's something that we want you to think about and others to think about. Do we want to change the designations? Now, we're trying to simplify it by making the grower only the grower. That's it. They don't do anything else, and they don't keep what they grow. They immediately deliver the usable marijuana to the patient for their use and their safekeeping. And I guess we thought that would clarify, but maybe it needs more work. So,
and I think Chair Morris and members of the committee, I think that might help in that a caregiver, you define what a caregiver is. And a caregiver is maybe a person who administers the marijuana, is allowed to bring the marijuana from the grower, those type of things. But if that caregiver is going to be a grower, they also register as a grower.
Okay.
And so a grower, this is what a grower does, this is what a caregiver does,
okay,
and a patient. And along that concern, that's the same concern, I know we've brought this up before, is that if you have, and I know that there's opposition to this, but if you have a patient that is so debilitated that they need someone else to grow for them, then we as law enforcement don't feel that patient should also be a grower. I mean, if I'm saying that I as a patient need someone else to grow for me, then right now, currently, they can have a caregiver growing for them, but mm-hmm. then they also can be a caregiver growing for someone else. So if I'm having to have someone grow for me, I would think that would mean that I'm so debilitated I cannot maintain a grow, I cannot lift the plants, I cannot water, move the highlight lights around, and those type of things. And so, therefore, I don't see how they can be a grower as well.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You know, it isn't just a matter of debilitation. I mean, if you're living in a small apartment, you just don't have the room, you know, you can't do it. And I guess what I'm looking at is if we have somebody who is a grower for four people, you know, and that's all they do for those four people is grow their medicine and then deliver the product. I just have a problem with our historic definition of caregiver in the state of Oregon to call that person a caregiver, because it's a different relationship. And so maybe we just need to, for this section of ORS, put some more definition behind both terms to make sure that the bright lines are still there, but I you know, personally, I think what we currently have blurs a whole lot of things, and I'd like to have some more clarity in that, because a grower is a grower and a caregiver is a caregiver, and you know, whether it's for somebody with marijuana as a medicine or some other form of drug as a medicine, we got a lot of caregivers that do those sorts of things for people. And I don't want over time to have that blurred into something else. And I mean, we kind of started this off in kind of a strange way. You know, we had a ballot measure and we've been trying to work with it over time, and it's been a rough road. And so some of these things are still kind of out there that need to be brought down and centered. So, when we're dealing with the terms, I think it's time, if we can, this time around, to put some clear definitions that'll stick. So,
okay. So we can have a patient, we can have a caregiver, we have a grower.
We just need to.
We can have a patient, we can have a caregiver / grower. Okay.
I think you'd also have a grower and a patient. Technically, a grower could hear himself be a patient and growing for further people.
Yeah, I'm not looking at definitions being mutually exclusive. They just need to be defined.
Okay, good. Okay, anything else?
Just the last one, just to reiterate on I think it is critical on the card issue as far as them, the person, when they're out and they're in possession, whether or not they're a caregiver or a patient, that they are required to carry some form on them. And if they do not, and that marijuana is taken from them, they have no cause of action. And I think that's an issue. And then, again, making sure that we have the repercussions in place for if you're convicted and you're a caregiver. I'm a caregiver, a grower. And those. I think with those and somehow getting to some kind of lower plant count, I think that we would be comfortable in supporting. So,
good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Dr. Rick Baer, Brian Michaels, and Lee Berger, would you please come up?
Can you go first this little thing?
Oh, sure.
Okay, who wants to go first?
I got to get settled here, please. May I?
Yes, Dr. Baer, please.
For the record, my name is Richard Baer, B-A-Y-E-R, M-D. My qualifications as a medical cannabis expert, practiced internal medicine for many years, cared for chronically ill patients, board certified in internal medicine. I co-authored a book, Is Marijuana the Right Medicine for You, that was published in 1998, was chief petitioner, co-author, and spokesperson for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act in 1998 that voters passed. Review literature about cannabis, maintain a website with an extensive medical cannabis bibliography, and authored a peer-reviewed article in the Journal of Cannabis Therapeutics, and previously testified in Oregon courts as an expert witness. I want to thank the committee, the patient advocates, thank you, the committee, and the staff for all your efforts. Nevertheless, there are some important problems with the Dash-3 amendments that would not allow true patient advocates to support the Dash-3 amendments as written, in my opinion. Specifically, in Section 2, and I'm really just going to talk about three sections, but in Section 2 is where the affirmative defense for cardholders is removed. This is controversial, but the logic seems to be that adding an unlimited number of non-flowering cuttings smaller than 1 foot, as mentioned in line 26, would make the affirmative defense no longer necessary for cardholders, and I appreciate the logic that has gone into this so that we're trying to find things that are better than what we have now to protect a patient, because we're not as married to the affirmative defense as some might think, but we're married to making sure that patients that are protected now do not become unprotected because of this Senate bill. We're really trying to protect the patients. And the removal of the affirmative defense for cardholders is reasonable on the surface. It'll work for experienced growers, for people that have been doing this a long time, but the 6-plant limit for novice growers, what if they kill the plants? What if they don't have a green thumb? I hate to see it be 6 plants, you're okay, 7 plants, you're in jail. And I'll explain that a little more in just a second. One of the solutions in this area would be to actually raise the number of plants to 10 to 14, because this would solve the problem for the novice grower who's going to kill half their plants. It's going to solve the problem for the outdoor grower who's only going to get one harvest a year, so they're not going to have the 2-grow-room method that Stormy and Jerry talk about so eloquently. The experienced grower is actually not going to suffer from removing the affirmative defense in Section 2. The only person who's going to suffer is the people who don't know what they're doing, which is the people that we're really trying to protect. Most patients could function either with a mandatory removal of the affirmative defense if the plant limit was raised, because that would give them some room for error. That's all I'm going to say about Section 2. In Section 9, changes the possession limit to 6 mature plants and 60 ounces of usable marijuana. Once again, this is going to be fine for experienced growers to get by with 6 plants, but I want to ask people to think about the inexperienced people or people that really don't know anything about marijuana. 10 to 14 plants without changing the usable marijuana possession limits would work, because the good growers could always plant less, but the bad or novice growers may need the 6 to 10 plants to get an adequate harvest. The only other thing about this section is we note there's still no requirement for either the patient or the caregiver requirement that the patient or program notify either the caregiver or the person responsible for the grow site of any change in patient caregiver status. And there's Mr. Berger may talk about that, but recently there was a person that was tried, and they had the cannabis in the car for their presumably a patient, and then the person was arrested and found out that the patient had a different caregiver and had never notified the caregiver that they weren't a caregiver anymore. So we need to work something out in this area. Section 11 is the part of the Dash 3 amendments where the affirmative defense for non-cardholders vanishes, and that's by removing sections 1, 2, and 4, but removing section 3, which is called the choice of evils defense. I personally feel that this is the worst part of the Dash 3 amendment group because it creates an unacceptable ethical problem where someone who may be protected under the current OMA could become unprotected. And it can be tempting for some, but in my opinion, the true patient advocates who are used to working with patients who don't have any money, like I practice internal medicine for so long, I think this is sort of a sellout of the cardholders selling out the non-cardholders to give up their defense. As a cardholder, I'm going to give up your defense. That really seems unethical to me. I'm sorry. It also seems that the removal of affirmative defense will effectively remove any defense for those who are not registered with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, and that would include people who have privacy issues, people who don't have the money to register, people who don't have internet access or know what the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act is. It really seems, once again, we're picking on the poorest and the defenseless, not the people in this room who have been studying this thing for years. I think the solution is to, at least right now, reinsert the affirmative defense, sections 1, 2, and 4. I'm sorry, numbers 1, 2, and 4 in section 11. Of course, the best solution is to make the affirmative defense not necessary, which is what you all tried to do in section 2. And that's really the emphasis that I think we need to be moving in, is to say, well, if people don't like the affirmative defense and our goal is to protect the patient, then how do we protect the patient without making law enforcement unhappy and so forth. Now, of course, one solution that we've testified about before is to make anyone who can qualify for a card punishable only by a fine and a violation, but no criminal charges. This would be consistent with this being a medical issue and having the decision made by the practitioner, like other medical decisions, rather than having the decision made by an administrative body. There are some patients who couldn't register even if they wanted to register because they don't have their debilitating condition listed. We've tried to get conditions like anxiety added in 2000. Somehow California has this condition and they haven't fallen into the ocean. Their program works fine. I think that it would help a lot of people with post-traumatic stress disorders. You know, we're so close to Memorial Day. We've got soldiers with post-traumatic stress disorders that I talked to the Veterans Hospital. They use cannabis for this. And yet, what we do now is we sort of make them lie a little bit and say, yeah, you've got post-traumatic stress disorder, but we'll give you the cannabis for your osteoarthritis in your ankle. And what we really need to do is be honest and acknowledge that there are people now that really need to qualify for the medical marijuana program who can't because of the severe restriction of our debilitating conditions. And if we turn that over to the physician or the attending physician, I think that would help take care of that. For those really uncomfortable for that, we do have a Oregon Death with Dignity Act that requires a second opinion from a physician. And so if somebody said, wow, we really don't like adding these new conditions, we could make them have to see two doctors to apply for the program if their condition wasn't in this group. And it's just my personal opinion that if two doctors are good enough to hasten your death, they should be good enough for a medicine that's never been shown to kill anybody in overdose settings, which makes it an incredibly unique medicine, one of the unique medicines that I would have ever prescribed if it was available, because most of the medicines I prescribe were very dangerous, including antibiotics and so forth. Only thing I have to say after this is in Section 12, that deletes the language relating to affirmative defense, and if the affirmative defense is reinserted in Section 11, it needs to be reinserted here also. and then a laundry list of things that you've heard before that we notice in 772 that there's nothing in there that prevents rating of the patient fees like we've got in HB 5077. There's nothing in 772 about reciprocity with other states, even though we've talked about that. There's nothing in there about rescheduling of marijuana or adding nurse practitioners as attending physicians. And so all of these things contribute to totally preventable arrest, trauma, and expense that we can prevent. In addition, there are problems about patients using medical marijuana after a patient is charged with a crime. So there are some things that need to be discussed. And I agree with Senator Cruz, we're not going to have to do it all with this bill, but I at least wanted to put these on the record. Finding consensus on the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act is a very difficult task. I don't have to tell anybody that. And to close, we are really impressed and thank you very much for all the progress that you made. On the other hand, we really don't want to rush into a bill that would hurt somebody because of the time limitations that these biennial sessions put us in. And I'd be happy to work with anybody that was interested in moving along to the 2007 session, even if we couldn't work things out this session. And I thank you very much for listening to me. That too.
Thank you, Dr. Baird.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. I'm doing my best to keep people who are novice at attending these hearings abreast of the fact that the chair has the authority to remove anyone who speaks out of turn. Part of the problem is the approach that the committee's taken in this hearing by limiting it to these three panels. And I mean, I'm not a patient or a caregiver or a grower, and there are patients and patient advocates and patients who are involved in groups that are promoting reform that haven't been allowed to speak, and I think that's some of the frustration.
Mr. Chair, I would say that during our previous hearings, we opened it up to anybody, so that's not quite true that we have been restrictive up till now.
Well, no, I'm sorry. I just meant at Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, I didn't mean to suggest that the committee's been restrictive up till now. I really, really appreciate how open the committee's been up till now. I was just trying to explain what some of the problems were at this hearing today. Mm-hmm. I want to speak first in...
Introduce yourself, please.
I thought I did. I'm Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I have a statewide...
I knew that, Mr. Chair.
I have a statewide practice that concentrates on the defense of medical cannabis patients and caregivers. I've represented patients and caregivers in 16 counties from Brookings to Baker City, from Ashland to Astoria. I helped write the Medical Marijuana Act. I helped write Measure 33 that received 43% of the vote at the last election. I serve on the Board of Directors of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I'm liaison to their legislative committee, the OCDLA and I both hope that we can achieve a workable bill, and I for one agree with the chair that, you know, we're not there yet and that it needs some more work. I wanted first to respond briefly to some of the conversation with the law enforcement panel. I wanted to emphasize some of the things that Dr. Baer was talking about and things that were left out that I'm hopeful you'll consider reinserting, and then I wanted to speak specifically to the -3 amendments and make some proposed changes. As to the quantity needed, when I last testified before the committee, I referred you to Chris Conrad's site, chrisconrad.com. The federal government, through the investigational new drug protocol, says 6 pounds a year. Mr. Conrad and his site says 3 pounds is what patients need. It's always interesting when law enforcement calculates out the number of cigarettes and the number of, but you know, a lot of patients don't smoke marijuana cigarettes. They use food or they use tinctures or they use poultices, and it requires significantly greater amounts. Furthermore, medical dose of cannabis is different both quantitatively and qualitatively from a recreational dose, and so if we're going to set an amount and say this is as much as we're going to allow, and we're not going to allow an affirmative defense for cardholders who have more, then we need to set it high enough so that it includes everybody. The reason for the unlimited seedlings is to move forward the science, which is determining which strains work best for which conditions. Is that certainly why you would want to have it to be unlimited? Mr. Wade or anybody else, I guess, can make suggestions about whether it's a 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 ratio of seedlings or starts to mature plants. I don't know what it is. I'm not a grower, but I think that it's important to try to leave. First of all, we greatly appreciate the statutory definition, and second of all, the unlimited number would advance that science, I'm suggesting to you. Concerning caregivers, you know, in Measure 33 and in Sandy Burbank's letter to the committee, she recommended that a designated primary caregiver be renamed medical marijuana caregiver. The Act defines designated primary caregiver in section 475302 sub 5, which is replicated on page 2 of the dash 3 amendments at line 6, meaning an individual 18 years of age or older has significant responsibility for managing the well-being of a person who's been diagnosed with a debilitating medical condition and who is designated as such on that person's application for a registry identification card or another written notification to the department, and it doesn't include the physician. The patient and patient advocate community, have always understood the significant responsibility for managing the well-being of a person in this context to mean the cultivation and delivery of medical cannabis. Dr. Higginson, I know, periodically has taken a different point of view, and I appreciate, especially Senator Cruz, your educating me about how it's a term of art in health law. I didn't know that ahead of time. But again, I think the suggestion that we change it from designated primary caregiver to designated marijuana caregiver solves that problem just by changing the name of it. The other changes that I had asked the committee to work on have to do with my interest in the Medical Marijuana Act. My interest is to not stand in front of a judge at sentencing ever again with a person for whom marijuana is medically necessary who's been convicted based on their medicinal use. It's wrong, it's improper, and I don't want to have to do it anymore, and that's how come I do this work. One legislative fix that's necessary that I wrote to the chair and vice chair of the committee, and along with Senator Prozanski and Representative March in an email on May 19th, has to do with the fact that although there may be some change in this attitude, thus far the medical marijuana program has taken the position that they lack administrative authority to notify caregivers when the patient changes the caregiver. Within the last month, I defended a man who was picking up his girlfriend at a restaurant, came back out, thought his car was stolen. We went to trial in Clackamas County before Judge Kniepes from Klamath Falls, who was sitting because that's what they do sometimes. They travel around. And he reported it as stolen. It turned out it had been repossessed. Canby police stopped it south of Oregon City, searched it, located 2 ounces. He had 2 caregiver cards in his wallet. It turned out one of the patients had discontinued him and didn't notify him, and the other one had failed to renew him, although he had renewed him 3 times previously, and it was consistent with the kind of delays that he'd experienced in the program, which is to say he reasonably believed that he was the caregiver for 2 patients. He reasonably believed that he was entitled or accepted from the criminal law for possessing 2 ounces of medical marijuana that he was delivering to the patients, and he's been prosecuted, and I'm not sure what she took it under advisement. So, and I don't have the verdict yet, but once I do, I'll be glad to share it with the committee. But that's an easy thing to be fixed legislatively, requiring the program to notify the caregiver when there's a change. The other changes are the ones that I didn't prepare written testimony this time, but I did on March 10th, and I included a letter I had sent to Mark McDonald, who's the head of the drug unit in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, outlining a series of changes in the criminal justice system relating to being a patient and being allowed to use medicine while you're released on recognizance, while you're in DUII diversion, while you're on probation, and while you're on parole or post-prison supervision. Though all those things vary county to county, although the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision has promulgated a policy regarding that, which I had faxed to Senator Pruszynski. He has a copy of it. I actually brought a copy with me if you want. I can leave that with you. But fixing the problem of patients who are caught up in the criminal justice system and making sure that is the kind of thing that is supposed to happen here in this building, as I understand it. It's a kind of make uniform how it is in between the various counties. I'm hopeful that you'll do that. Turning to the specific proposed amendments, on page 2, section 1, amending 475302 sub 3, I greatly appreciate the committee having recommended a change that accepts or that explains that delivery does not include transfer of marijuana by a registry identification card holder to another registry identification card holder if no consideration is paid for the transfer. That's of great assistance. The program has historically taken a contrary view, even though all of the patients and all of the patient advocates, including actually the Stormy Ray Foundation, agrees with the construction that the committee's put on it. I would recommend, however, that you add this sentence. The payment for production of the marijuana shall not constitute consideration. We during the Legislative Advisory Committee hearings that were held, Senator Marr said, in response to your letter to the Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Higginson, we had proposed this. It seemed like a simple enough thing. Scott, it seemed reasonable to everybody except to Scott Heiser, who was the head of the district attorney in Benton County from the Oregon District Attorneys Association, who was worried that it was a slippery slope. It's not a slippery slope. And It would help greatly if that sentence were added there. I did want to, by the way, respond to the reason why Lieutenant Durbin doesn't think that there's a problem with there being an adequate number of caregivers is that no patient who needs a caregiver calls Craig Durbin. They call Oregon Normal, and Madeline Martinez returns those calls, and there's a long list of people. They call Oregon Green Free. Jim Clark told me today, I think, that there was a backlog of 50 people. There's an inadequate number of people. I mean, the reason why everyone in the medical marijuana advocacy community, excepting the Stormy Ray Foundation and another group, supported Measure 33 is because there's an inadequate supply of medical marijuana for patients. That's the problem. There needs ultimately to be dispensaries, and hopefully the Supreme Court, in deciding Raich versus Walters, will move us closer to that. But in Section 2, as Dr. Baer described, the proposal is to repeal the affirmative defense for cardholders. And again, if there's an adequate, as I outlined in my letter to Mr. McDonald that's in the March 10th testimony, if there's an adequate number of plants so that nobody's left behind, then that's not a problem. Where it becomes a problem is later on, where the other affirmative defenses in 475319 are repealed. But turning next to Section 3...
What about a background check for prospective growers to see if they have been convicted of a marijuana violation at some point?
Well, the thing of it is, I told you that I wasn't a medical marijuana patient because I'm not a medical marijuana patient, and I'm also not a grower. Mm-hmm. I've seen a lot of medical marijuana gardens over the last 6 years, or actually 8 years, because before the law I was defending patients as well. And as best I can tell you, it's not rocket science, but it's not tomatoes either. I mean, I grow cherry tomatoes because my wife likes cherry tomatoes.
The question is, okay.
So the people that have those skills are likely to have been arrested or prosecuted before. That's the problem. Or they escape detection. I mean, those are the two possibilities.
Now, law enforcement, I think, tends to take the position that growers would love to come to Oregon to be able to participate in the program if we allow too much marijuana to be held on site and so on. There is a built-in suspicion, I think, of growers in general. You take the position that the only people who want to grow are people who are very empathetic to the needs of patients and are willing to do it. Now, I guess if you did a background check, that could, as you say, cause some problems for people who are experienced growers who are doing it for the right reason. And I think therein lies the problem in terms of who is going to be the grower. I don't know how you solve that. Now, if a person, okay, what you're saying then, some of the people who are growers have indeed been growers before for probably the wrong reason, but they are volunteering to grow now for people who need the medicine. Now, is that a mutually exclusive charitable work? Can only people who have, okay, you're saying people who don't have the experience of being growers are going to have a problem in learning. Therefore, you need people who are experienced, and I'm wondering. I'm wrestling with whether or not there should be or could be a background check or a training program for people who don't have the experience and want to become growers. Now, I don't know how you... Maybe there is a training program. I don't know.
Senator Moore said, members of the committee, there it is one of the things that some of the advocacy groups have been doing is training patients and caregivers in cultivation techniques. They advertise that this is what they do. Mr. Sage has done this through Voter Power. Mr. Delato has done this through the Eugene Compassion Center. It's not a secret.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly is a thing that people are trained to do. Law enforcement is suspicious because law enforcement is suspicious, and I can't help you with the fact that they're suspicious, and I can't help you with the fact that they're thinking that it's going to be diverted outside of the medical. But you know, Senator Morrison, if there's 10,000 patients and another 5,000 caregivers, and the 5,000 caregivers are providing for these patients without consideration because that's what the law requires, that means that there are 10,000 patients that aren't getting marijuana from the illegal market anymore. And law enforcement never talks about that. 10,000 patients, 6,000 or 6 pounds a year, $4,000 a pound. The Medical Marijuana Act has been the greatest transfer, the greatest depletion of the illegal market that could have occurred. And the notion that there's this, you know, in the 2003 legislature, Lieutenant Dermod's predecessor, Larry Welty, testified before a House committee. Representative Gordon Anderson said, well, you say there have been all these abuses. How many abuses have there been? And he said, well, there's been 50 abuses. And Representative Anderson said, well, you know, 50 abuses, 4 years, 12 a year. You know, that doesn't seem like a lot. And I think, too, it's important to remember, respectfully, that we're not talking about crack cocaine, that we're not talking about heroin, that we're not talking about methamphetamine, but that we're talking about cannabis, which, as Dr. Bears pointed out, has an LD of zero. It isn't the kind of poison that can be leaked out into the community than when we're talking about other kinds of controlled substances. So I think it's important to keep that in perspective when law enforcement raises these kinds of concerns.
Well, let me also just say, I guess, in all fairness to law enforcement, their job is to catch the bad guy.
Yes.
And they're working in an area that is oftentimes blurred and unclear. And I think what we're trying to do is clarify and make it easier for legitimate grower-patient relationships to occur, make it easier for them to occur, and make it easier for law enforcement to try to differentiate. And that's what it's all about. I mean, it's trying to make it a better system all the way around.
Chair Morrison, members of the committee, that's why I'm here. I share that goal.
Yeah.
I don't think background checks is the path to it,
however. Okay, thank you.
In Section 3, Dr. Baer spoke briefly about House Bill 5077. That's the bill that resolves the last biennium's DHS budget by, among other things, by reappropriating about, I think, $64 million. $900,000 of those dollars is the surplus from the medical marijuana program. It's wrong to fix the department's budget on the protection money paid by sick and dying people. It's just wrong.
I agree.
And I'm wondering, and I don't know how to fix it, but I'm hoping that one way to fix it, you know, in the discussion groups that we have online, there's things about that it can be dedicated or the funds could be dedicated. If we were to write in that the fees were to be dedicated and only used for the program, the location within the Medical Marijuana Act where I think that could be would be in 475309, which is the Registry Act. So I encourage the committee in coming up with the next draft to add language to make sure that we don't have a situation like 5077 again.
I agree. I did talk to Dr. Higginson last week, and he was under the impression that the money, are, you know, that fee-based reserve had some protection. And he mentioned that he had been telling people that, but that does not turn out to be the case because there is nothing in the statute that protects fee-based reserves, period. Now, I agree. I think it's... Okay, let me back up just a bit. I would like, in this next session... Well... Let me back up even further. I have suggested to the Senate co-chair that at least $200,000 be left in the reserve account for a variety of reasons. First, I'm not sure if we're going to have a problem going forward with the existing fee structure. I would hate to have to raise it again after having taken the reserve based on fees away. Secondly, if we're going to improve the system by a quicker turnaround of cards, I'm not convinced that it can be done within a two-week period under the existing allotment of money. I don't think so. And Dr. Higginson indicated to me that he thought it could. And what I talked with him about is, do we need to have a reserve to make the improvements that we need so people would get a card almost immediately after they applied, within 2 weeks? And that would be the goal. Now, I understand that some cards took months. That turnaround time was totally unacceptable. So not only do I want to keep at least $200,000 in the reserve, and I'm not sure if that's possible at this point, but I definitely would like to write into legislation that for this particular program that either usually fees are readjusted by the subcommittee on ways and means, and I am on this on one of the subcommittees now, and we spend a lot of time talking about the construction contractors' fees to make sure that there is not an excess. I don't know how it escaped that kind of scrutiny in the Ways and Means Subcommittee dealing with the health services. I just don't know, because we do it with every other fee-based organization. So I think Dr. Higginson's assumption that the fees were safe was based on the fact that nobody ever told him otherwise. Otherwise, that the fee would have been reduced immediately and a reasonable carryover would have been allowed. So... We want to have a reasonable carryover. We want to have a clear understanding if we want to. Now, the only way it would be justified in keeping a fee base is if we made future capital improvements, one of which I think would be a central grow site. There was a bill introduced 2 years ago by Representative Krupp to have a central grow site. That would solve a lot of problems, and the only way it could be done is if there was a reserve to get started on that. Now, if we go there, I would ask that a general fund appropriation be made back into the reserve in order to allow that to happen. So I'm trying to cover the fee base in several different ways, because I think to make it almost perfect system, you have to have a central growth site and deal with the distribution in a completely different way than we're doing it now. That would safeguard the marijuana grow. It would safeguard the amount that an individual would need and make sure it was adequate at all times. That would be the perfect system. And I don't know why we can't do that. As far as I know, the feds are doing it in the state of Mississippi, as far as I know. And so that, to me, would be the goal, is to work toward that, but we need some capital reserve to do that. So I understand what you're saying, and I think it's that, that a complete surprise. I talked to one representative who was involved in that House transfer of funds, and he didn't know if it was if the horse was already out of the barn and we could do anything about it this time, but I'm trying to get it done on the Senate side.
Chair Morrison, members of the committee, I appreciate the chair's efforts in trying to put the horse back in the barn. In terms of raising the fees, I think it's going to have to do with whether we can persuade Dr. Higginson that we're going to be able to continue to increase the number of patients that are applying. In terms of capital improvements, both in the original draft of Senate Bill 772 and in whether it happens through legislation or through the advisory committee, one thing law enforcement and the advocates, all the advocates, have always agreed on is this 24/7 verification. Okay. And when we last priced that, yeah, we priced that at about $250,000. The card turnaround has improved, and if it would be of assistance to the committee, I'd be glad to take a stab at drafting a central grow site state-run distribution system.
Do it.
Okay.
It won't hurt, it won't help, but it won't. It may not help.
All right.
Okay, we're going to have to move along.
I have just actually a couple of other things I want to say. I'm almost done, I promise. I was born in New York, so I can talk really fast. The greatest... in terms of this grower thing, the person responsible for the grow site, first of all, if that person is going to be delivering the medicine to the patient, then that person will need a card other than the card that's posted at the grow site, and the bill doesn't make a provision for that. Second of all, it's okay to limit that person to four patients or designated primary caregivers, so long as the designated primary caregivers can continue to have an unlimited number of patients. But if we're saying that there can't be any cultivation anywhere for more than four patients, then that's a deal breaker. I want to be really clear about that.
Run through that one more time.
Under current law, there's no limitation on the number of patients a caregiver can be the caregiver for. This bill says that if you are a person, and a caregiver could cultivate for a patient, and there doesn't need to be a person responsible for a grow site. The caregiver doesn't have to separately register as person responsible for a grow site, do they?
Grow sites are going to have to be registered.
Senator Morsett, Chair Morsett, Senator Cruz, there are currently multiple patient gardens of where people are looking after a dozen or more patients. If caregivers, or if we call them growers, or if we call them persons responsible for care sites, are limited to only four patients that they can take care of, it will so further exacerbate the supply of medicine to patients as to make it, you know, almost non-existent. More patients will do without. As it is now in Oregon, at any given time, some patient somewhere is without medication. This will greatly increase that number if we limit it to four. Concerning the affirmative defense repeal from 319, which is in Section 11, the problem is that there isn't anything to replace the protection that's given to patients who can't register or who didn't. And there needs to be the suggestions for what those things could be. I've included, again, in my written testimony in my letter to Mr. McDonnell, either expanding, as Dr. Baer testified, the number of conditions that apply, or allowing nurse practitioners and naturopaths to be attending physicians, or allowing the attending physician to decide what conditions apply. Lastly, there's a problem with the existing 475.319 sub 3, which is all that remains of 475.319 after the -3 amendments, and it's on page 12 from lines 2 through 10, and the problem is twofold. The first is that it states clearly that nobody is precluded from presenting evidence supporting the necessity of marijuana for treatment of a specific disease or medical condition, but it doesn't create a medical necessity defense. So if you want to protect those patients, then you need to add the language for the purpose of presenting a or somehow creating it as a defense, that it shall be a defense that it's medically necessary and no patient shall be presented or prevented from presenting it. And then the second problem is that our appellate courts have construed the choice of evils defense in such a way as to make it virtually inapplicable to any patient or caregiver who's cultivating. Choice of evils defense in 161-200 requires that the act was taken in response to imminent harm. And because cultivation requires 60 or 90 or 120 or however many days to grow, and because the Court of Appeals in a case State versus Miles, M-I-L-E-S, decided in the last few months, said that the defendant has to make a showing that of evidence that from which a jury could infer that it was imminent, it's not going to work. So the way to correct that is to say that no one shall be precluded from presenting a choice of a defense of choice of evils, except that no patient or caregiver shall be required, or no person shall be required to prove that the threat was imminent. If we take away the imminence requirement, then we still have the common law justification defense, and it would be available to patients and cardholders. It may actually be adequate even if the other affirmative defenses are repealed. Mr. Michaels and I have a difference of opinion about that, but I would be remiss if I didn't suggest that possibility. I greatly appreciate your allowing me this time to testify. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you. Brian, you get a chance to talk about the efficacy, the medical efficacy of marijuana, right? You just mentioned that. Now, I don't know that there has been definitive studies, or have there been? If there have been, why don't we have a Category 3 listing for marijuana? That would be another goal, is to move it into a different drug category.
Chairman, are you asking me?
Well,
as Chairman said, members of the committee, the Congress has rescheduled Marinol, which or dronabinol is marketed as Marinol, which is synthetic THC, true, as Schedule 3.
Yeah.
So too should marijuana be rescheduled.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead, Brian, introduce yourself, and you can talk about that if you want to, or just...
Thank you. It's a little out of order, but I'll address it because it's in order right now. It's a little out of order of what I was going to address. But part of the written materials you have here that have been handed out that I prepared include the rationalization for rescheduling marijuana to Schedule 2. As a matter of simple law, Schedule 1...
Would you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry, Brian Michaels. I'm an attorney from Eugene,
okay,
and I have done a lot of medical marijuana cases around the state. I've had some successful jury verdicts in all kinds of different counties, conservative, rural, liberal, what have you. It has been my impression that juries represent the voters, and the voters and the jury seem to get medical marijuana real good. That the people who have made a career of prosecuting, investigating, arresting, and sentencing people for marijuana, taking their children away, taking their property away, taking their freedom away, really haven't come far along and are way behind the ball on this subject. And it's probably because we really can't legislate their behavior or their attitude. Years and years and years of inertia of doing these things to people, which are horrible things to do to people if there's no good reason for it, are going to stay with them for a long time. And so as they view marijuana and the people who use marijuana, they really don't change their attitude a whole lot for the most part. Juries, on the other hand, do quite well. They don't come to a trial with a whole lot of baggage of having dealt with marijuana people in the past. They see the issue fresh.
In all fairness to law enforcement, they have to do their job to prosecute the offenders of a drug that is listed as a felony to misuse. I mean, and so there, I agree that there is no clear, bright line oftentimes between
the legal use and the illegal use, and we have conflicting statutes in Oregon. We have a law that says it's okay to use it. It is a medicine. You can use it. We have a law that says if you are in possession of the same amount of money or the same amount of medicine or marijuana and you don't have a card, it's a felony. I mean, it's very, very difficult for law enforcement to differentiate. And so I empathize with their concerns.
Well, if I may be so bold, Chairman, there are many, many drugs that are harmful that are, if you have a prescription, you're legal. If you don't have a prescription, you're not. Rush Limbaugh, of course, has felt the pain of one of these drugs. So that rationale goes so far, but it really doesn't, on my view, take on the whole issue. I don't necessarily blame law enforcement for having slow coming around to change their attitude. I just recognize it as a factor of human nature. And I mention this because part of their remarks I would like to respond to, because consistent with the view that somehow marijuana users, regardless of being legal or not, are somehow sub-citizen, comes the fact that somehow we should open up our houses to law enforcement at their will and whim, as opposed to regular citizens who have rights to keep people out of their home at their will and whim. To see marijuana growers for medical reasons that way is consistent with an inability to see them as citizens trying to do the best for their health that they can. They wouldn't do it for other prescriptions. They wouldn't say, you've got OxyContin in this house. I want to come in and see how many you're using each day.
Okay.
They would never view people that way.
Okay.
As I move on to, I guess scheduling is where we were before I ranted on about that. In the written materials that you have is at number three, scheduling marijuana or schedule two. The basis for a controlled substance to be in schedule one is that there's no identifiable medical use. Well within the confines of an act called the Medical Marijuana Act would be a recognition that there is a medical use for marijuana. It seems to just be consistent. And then once you recognize that there is a medical use of marijuana, then naturally marijuana falls right into Schedule 2, almost by definition. It can be done with the stroke of a pen by the legislature in this bill, or it can take a lot of litigation through the courts in order to get it done, ordering the Board of Pharmacy to do it because the law requires them to. It seems easiest and most logical for us, once we recognize that there is a medical use of marijuana, to accept the fact that it is, by definition, a Schedule 2. It's really just the other shoe falling. I've given you the statute for the authority to control schedules, how it works, and all of that. And it can go through the Board of Pharmacy. But as you know, the statute trumps the administrative action. You can't do that action on your own. You don't need to succumb to the administrative agency. Some of the other items I wanted to discuss, naturally on the first page, is a comment about my own personal confusion about the inclusion of a grower as opposed to a caregiver. I think Senator Cruz has cleared that up quite well before. I understand the rationale behind the committee. I really offer no opinion on it. It seems, now that I understand what you're doing, to make sense. I concur with Mr. Berger. There needs to be a card for that person so that when that person transports it to the patient or the caregiver, that person is covered. Getting to the amount of marijuana, amount of patients a caregiver can grow, I'm just a lawyer. I just do medical marijuana cases. I have people calling me because they don't have a caregiver. And they know that I am familiar with the medical marijuana laws. So it is a severe problem. I have a person now who's in her 60s, who's very physically debilitated. Happens to be somebody I've known for a long time, who's had a medical marijuana card for a while because of her severe physical debilitation. Her caregiver just decided he doesn't want to do it anymore. She's physically unable to do it. I don't know what to do. It's sad. the pain she's going to endure until she gets a caregiver is going to be enormous. And there's just no question about it. And just so the committee's clear, several of my clients have been people who did not come from the recreational drug culture. Several of my clients have been drug-free, straight people who never would think of using drugs, who for some medical reason were unhappy with the treatment they were getting and were offered marijuana and chose it in a minute. One of them was handed it to her by her mother while her mother lay on her deathbed from cancer because somebody had given her the marijuana as a pain relief while she was going through chemo. And her mother knew that the many years of debilitating ailments this woman experienced and lack of treatment she was getting, the mother on her deathbed in the hospital said, "Here, try this. It seems to work for me." And that woman did. And her and her very straight-laced husband began growing marijuana because for the first time, she was happy and free of medical issues. Its value is undeniable. When you see it before you, you just kind of scream and say, why can't this be more widespread? And so when you limit the amount of caregivers, amount of patients a caregiver can do, because of the unique nature of marijuana, I mean, if you think about it, a lot of the problems are that we have all these kind of machinations and moving parts about how does a person acquire this particular product. Almost every other product we acquire, we go somewhere and we buy it. It's a simple act, one step, moving, no moving parts. You just go and buy it. But here you've got to have some personal access to somebody who can grow it, or you've got to grow it. It's remarkably unique. And then you've got all these little issues about transporting it and moving it and who's going to do it and how do you get to know someone who's going to. It's remarkably unique. And there's some people who seem to do it really well. I mean, I had a client down in Roseburg. He had like 15 patients. And people just liked using him as a caregiver. He grew it well, he enjoyed doing it, and life was good. But if you limit him to four, well, there's like 11 people, and I have to go looking around for someone. And this guy happened to get arrested, so I met all his clients, I mean, all his patients. We went to court. It was all kind of washed away. But these were people who, very much like I said before, who are now free from a lot of medical treatment they didn't find helpful and now are having a new life. So I can't emphasize enough the problems that are going to be created if patients aren't allowed to have access to caregivers or growers, however you want to make that particular situation happen. And it's because of the weird, unique nature of this access to marijuana. Now, the next issue I want to address are issues that were not in the bill. And one is attending physicians. I see that as the squeeze in the hose that's delivering marijuana to people, because if the Board of Medical Examiners once again puts the fear of God into doctors, then access to by patients to medical marijuana is going to dry up. On the other hand, if you disperse that political fallout to other qualified medical professionals, nurse practitioners and naturopaths already subscribe Schedule II medications. The idea that somehow they're not going to be as responsible as doctors is, I think, an insult to these particular professions. They're licensed and bonded and boarded, board certified. They treat patients for their health reasons. Why are they all of a sudden going to go nuts? They're not. They're going to continue to treat their patients the best way they can, and if it's giving them marijuana, then what's wrong with that? And by the way, a few of my non-card affirmative defense folks, in fact, one of them was a trial I won in Linn County, was because he couldn't find a doctor to sign his card up. He had a personal physician. He had been injured on the job, and he had been being treated by his personal physician. He didn't like the dummy drugs. They didn't get him through the day very well. And in his own words, he couldn't hug his children. Once he got introduced to marijuana, suddenly his life reopened again. But he had to go to court because he couldn't find a doctor to sign his card. Had there been naturopaths and had there been large practitioners, and if that political fallout been dispersed, he may well have had that. I next address what was left out of the bill in terms of confidentiality. As we move toward law enforcement receiving information in order to enhance their investigation, I think we need to ensure that that information is sealed, and we haven't done that. We all know somebody who was arrested by the federal government because the local sheriff turned over the medical marijuana information to the feds. They should be precluded from doing this. This is not why they get the information. And it's a simple few words in the statute that would preclude them from releasing the information to anyone else. Number three is scheduling of marijuana, and we did that. And number four is reciprocity. Reciprocity is my client's driving through Oregon to go from California to Washington. He's got a California medical marijuana card. He gets arrested because he doesn't have an Oregon medical marijuana card. Other scenario I had was California resident comes to Oregon to go to school. He's here for a couple of months. He still has his California medical marijuana card. Is he a criminal in Oregon or not? Well, attached to this letter is a memo I did indicating that in all likelihood there's a strong legal basis as it stands now that we would have to recognize the medical marijuana card in the state of California. But why go through all that litigation? Why put these people in criminal jeopardy? And frankly, why ask them to pay someone like me to go through all this? When all we can say is in Medical Marijuana Act, since we recognize the medical use of marijuana for Oregon citizens, we would recognize the medical use of marijuana for citizens in other states who recognize the medical use of marijuana. It's not a leap of faith to say that. It's almost a house cleaning item.
Do other states have reciprocity?
One other state. I don't know, and I only know that Oregon doesn't.
We'll get this. I want to maintain our decorum, so to speak.
Yes. but I don't
but
know
I,
anything about.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Mr. Berg is informing me Montana's recent bill has a reciprocity.
We'll take a look at the reciprocity issue because I think that makes sense. We do it for, in fact, every session we expand our reciprocity in different medical areas. Dentistry, we just accept it to people from the Northeast region who have the license there and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And so that makes sense to look at that. Okay.
Other than that, those are the issues I wrote on to bring in that we discussed that I would talk about.
Okay.
I would say a couple of items just in response to things I've heard before, just sort of as a cleanup. The idea that growers are going to come to Oregon sort of laughs in the face of California because the amount of plants you can grow in California is just so lopsided compared to what we're asking in this bill. You can grow hundreds in California. And that's why California ends up in the court so much, in federal court, that is, because the feds think that California grows enough marijuana plants for them to take an interest in. And they don't like to take an interest in small matters. And they're not going to take an interest in these small matters of the few plants we have here. But they will take an interest in hundreds of plants. And that's why you see that all the cases that have gone up about medical marijuana have come out of California. So the idea is somebody's thinking of traveling to a state to grow marijuana, why would they go here and not California? It wouldn't make any sense. And the other thing I want to say about caregivers and patients that I circled when law enforcement said something else is this. I have a lot of clients who are patients and live together, and I always advise them to be each other's caregiver, because I've had clients who were arrested for caring for their roommate's marijuana garden when their roommate wasn't home, and therefore, since they didn't have the authority to do it, they were committing the crime of growing marijuana. So there's kind of this legal loophole that gets filled if people have a caregiver or somebody else who's legally allowed to tend their garden for when they go on vacation or just for a matter of just simple daily life convenience. There's somebody else there to back them up that's not going to subject themselves to criminal sanctions. So there are reasons why a patient might want to be a caregiver and have a care someone caregiver for them. I think that's all I have, and I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Yes. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Stormy, Ray, Jerry, Wade, and Michael Getz. What? Blaze. Michael Getz.
Would you hand him my
Michael, do you want to start?
I think we're going to start.
No, I'm going to disrupt the order here. Stormy, go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Morissette and committee members. We appreciate you continuing to work on this version. I've been very ill, so
yeah.
I'll try
to introduce yourself, please.
Okay, my name is Stormy Ray. Okay. I am the president of the Stormy Ray Cardholders Foundation. I was also one of the chief petitioners for Measure 67 when we started way back when. I have been ill, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. I'll leave that up to my other two colleagues. But I do have a few things that I'd like to address. When I hear testimonies and I hear input at the various website chat rooms that are going on, I see that there is a lot of confusion between what is a OMMP patient and what is black market illegal growers activity. I can see why the police have a little bit of problems with this particular program. We do not have clear defined lines that make it better for everybody. Patients need more of the medical marijuana that they have grown without harsh chemicals to be there for their medical supply. Patients need 7 plants to best establish and maintain a productive garden. Patients need up to 21 ounces at a time. That gives us room to do a harvest of a plant or 2 or 3 or even up to the entire 7, take 3 ounces and keep it in our medicine supply bank and still maybe have a little bit to share with those that don't have a harvest yet. One of the reasons that this program has gotten to the size that it has been patients helping each other. And that includes some very, very precious caregivers who have always been there to help the patient find the medicine they need. I know that you're looking at the word grower. I almost cringe when I hear that because it's always been associated with things that were outside of OMA and outside of the OMMP program. With 21 ounces, most patients will have enough in their bank, whether they're medicating by smoking it or using tinctures or herbs, to make it till their next harvest. By being able to have 21 ounces at all times,
if I go and make up a special hash that I can use very effectively at night, and it takes 5 ounces, I could still network with someone else to replace the 5 ounces that I've used. The chances of running out, if networking is occurring also, is very low. The next thing that we would ask is that you delete the third location grow site that is not under the control of the patient or the caregiver. The biggest problem that I personally have had to deal with out here has been people diverting medicine away from the patients. Yes, we need more medicine, every one of us out here. But we don't need an entity that is just growing medicine and has no or little reason, medical necessity reason for doing it. To have
what's a third location grow site?
I don't know. It's
under the
mentioned several times.
Either the patient.
Now introduce yourself, please, Jerry.
Oh, okay.
Introduce yourself.
Okay, my name is Jerry Wade, and I am the secretary for the Stormy Ray Foundation, a patient in this program, and I've been a caregiver at
Give us the third location grow site.
What we understand from /3, there is three setup. You either have the caregiver, or you have a separate grow site with a separate grower that is provides medicine to either the patient or the caregiver. That's in the /3. And the problem with that is it's one step removed, again, for the patient from their medicine. And
now, wait a minute. Don't we have growers, caregivers,
mm-hmm.
that grow and deliver to the patient now?
Yes. That's okay. Why we don't think we need this next category.
I don't think there is a next step.
Yes. The current 7.3 creates a third category of grower that would provide medicine to both the caregiver and the patient.
Excuse me while I consult with my vice chair on this. I don't know that we...
It's a matter of semantics, I think, basically here. Yeah, and, Jerry, I know what you're saying there. We aren't necessarily saying a third person, but it gets back to the discussion we had earlier. It's the Scribner's art more than anything as traditional definition of caregiver. Now, you can have a caregiver who's taking care of daily needs and stuff like that and can be a grower, but there are people who have people that all, somebody's got a garden and they're growing for several people. Chances are all they're doing for some of those people is growing.
That's most of the cases.
And I guess that's the differentiation we're looking at. Just from the definition we have had in statute forever, well, not forever and ever, but for a long time of what a caregiver is, and not wanting to lump a whole nother class of folks into there that might be confusing in another context.
Now, if you look at 772/3, though, you set up the third grow site, and it says that the medical marijuana produced at the end of the grow, when the caregiver is through growing for the patient, must be given to the patient.
Okay. Right.
But it doesn't say that their caregiver can't grow 3 cycles a year or ever.
We dropped that.
Okay, that's been gone.
We are not dealing with an annual grow only.
Just year.
I realize that, but this caregiver, this grower, as a third party, it says in the thing that as on completion of the grow. So this guy is growing around the clock. There is nothing in the bill as written that says that the medicine that is being grown must be given to the patient. It says that they could be shared between the patient, the caregiver, and the grower.
Time out. Our intent.
Okay.
Was to, first of all, we did discuss an annual grow only. We abandoned that.
Okay.
And secondly, we discussed that the patient will receive all of the result of a grow as soon as possible, so that in keeping with the idea that the marijuana belongs to the patient, that the grower won't keep it for him or her, will deliver it, and that's the intent. So we don't have a third option. Annual one-time only grow.
I realize that was the intent, but as actual as 773 in written, it doesn't do that.
Yeah, and you're right, it doesn't.
Okay.
That's,
we didn't take that up?
No, it's just not clearly defined.
Okay.
It's all. I mean, there were several omissions in this and other things that I don't think were as defined as clearly as we wanted. And that's one.
Yeah, okay.
And then I would like to finish by saying that I would like to recommend that we not put a number 4 on the patients per caregiver, but that we increase that to a number 7. With 7 patients, the workload can be handled. You get much over 7, and you've got somebody there every day at night working and protecting those plants. Mm. And we think for most of us, that's just not necessary.
Now, currently there is no limit,
correct,
on how many patients a grower can grow for. We've heard testimony it's up to 12 or more. And we also heard testimony that the reason is that there is a shortage of growers. We heard conflicting testimony that there is not a shortage of growers. So my question to you is, do we have enough people willing to perform that necessary function for the benefit of patients?
I'd like to answer this one. When a patient assigns a caregiver, they are giving that person possession of something that's worth more than gold. And not as many of those relationships make it as I would like to see, for many reasons. You know that we've just gone through a bad referendum or initiative that hurt a lot of relationships between patients and their caregivers. And yeah, there's always someone who needs a patient or needs a caregiver. But the problem is we can't just assign those over to anybody. This has got to stay under the patient or their assigned caregiver's control. Or we will have hidden dualies again, which you may not even know, but recently we had a situation where a patient had 7 plant gardens. They were told it'd be okay to have 7 more. One thing is they put that out with their caregiver and left no way for verification that it even existed. So they became hidden gardens. That also has very much so hurt patients out here getting the medicine, because not only was the caregiver at risk, so was the patient's garden.
Okay, now that gets back to requiring the caregiver to give notice when they discontinue. No, the patient giving notice when they discontinue a caregiver, which they don't do. So
either way,
or
both ways.
And so what you're describing is against the law.
Well,
yes.
Yeah, but and that's one of the reasons why law enforcement gets nervous, is that there may be things going out there that are against the law. But as it was also stated, given the great number of legitimate people who are involved, the number isn't extremely high. There are always going to be some people who are not being honest. I mean, in any endeavor.
Well, again, to me, answer the same question is there is a desperate need for honest caregivers in this program.
Okay.
And one of the problems with the program we currently have is if I am a patient and I do not know how to grow, or I'm unable to grow, don't have a place to grow, whatever the reason, and I assign somebody to be my caregiver, and 4 to 5 months down the road, that person doesn't give me what's been grown, there is no recourse. If I go to the health department and complain about it, they tell me they have no authority. They tell me to call the police if I think a crime's been committed. If I call the police, they tell me there is nothing they can do, and all they say is file a civil suit. Well, most patients in this program have trouble coming up with the registration fee, let alone hiring a lawyer and going through court. And even if you go through court, it's still my word against my caregiver's word that the medicine ever existed. And it really creates a very serious problem, because right now what is happening, and it is, we get many calls a week about this, where a patient will sign up a caregiver, have this person 5 or 6 months, and the person will give them a half ounce a month, an ounce a month, charge them for it. And then, you know, they're not getting but a token share of what's actually being grown for them. And if they complain about it, all they can really do is fire
them. What's your solution?
I see the solution to that, of course, as the first one, which is when a plant is harvested, the medicine goes to the patient. Good. And I also see giving the health department the authority to arbitrate between disputes. Now, it would not have to be inspections. They could do phone interviews with the other members of the gardens, phone interviews with the caregiver, you know, and determine what's going on. And caregivers that have been fired by 20 patients over the year because, you know, there's a problem there, the health department could review that situation and make a determination. In fact, what I would like to see is the advisory panel that's being created by this bill give them the authority, a jury of their peers, basically, to review the evidence and determine the appropriate action.
We have a whole series of ombudspersons assigned to different areas in health,
right,
basically. And it sounds like that's the kind of position you're describing, as someone whose job it is to be called in to investigate and in some cases even make visits. And that's an interesting idea, because we've talked about creating a position.
We get into time lags here, but I think what Jerry's talking about, Mr. Chair, would be more, I mean, there's committees that exist, and having them be, you know, do the fact finding and make determination whether there's merit, and at that point, well, there's cause to move.
Okay, it's right. A staff situation.
And I would rather these problems be handled in house, the program policing itself, well, than somebody having to come in and do it for us.
Okay, that's
similar to what they're trying to do with the medical panel for malpractice in a way, you know, just having the body that already exists be the finders of fact and determination of merit.
Well, okay, that's something we can look at. And,
and the next issue I'd like to talk about is the affirmative defense. As you noticed, this has been a very contentious issue about a law, and I really support the idea that Lieutenant Craig Durbin and the Stormy Ray Foundation were able to agree upon, which is removing the part of the affirmative defense that allows for extra plants and increased amounts of medicine to be possessed, but retaining the parts of the affirmative defense that would, if a patient was arrested and not registered in the program or for whatever reason and would have qualified for the program, that they would still remain that part of the affirmative defense. The entire point of the OMA when it was written was that no patient would ever be arrested and charged for the medical use of marijuana. And retaining those parts of the affirmative defense that protect the patient as far as, and there are reasons. There are people with jobs that if they found out at the job that they were on the medical marijuana program, they would be fired. And there are a lot of people that have not registered in this program because of that, or the money issue, or their privacy issues, different things that, and most of these fears, I think, are kind of unfounded. I think the program has become very solid and safe, but those fears are still out there. And I can't see arresting somebody and charging them for medically using marijuana just because they had not, you know, if they were clearly using it for medical purposes.
Well.
And so, like I said, if we could just split it and take out the parts that allow for extra medicine and extra plants, but keep the parts of the affirmative defense that if somebody had not registered but would have otherwise qualified, they still have a defense in front of a judge. Now, they still have to prove that this was medical use in front of that judge. They still have to prove.
Excuse me. Now, what you're recommending then is that in for people who, for whatever reason, choose not to get a card, if they are arrested for using mm-hmm. medical marijuana for a medical reason, they would have an affirmative defense.
Correct.
Wow. That really opens it up.
But getting rid of the other part.
Jerry, if I'm an employer, do I have the ability to find out now if my employee has a card? I don't, do I? I mean,
an employer can do your analysis test, and if they fail it,
it. I cannot call the health department and get that information.
No, they can't.
Protected information. That's
and, I mean, which is why I think
it's covered under HIPAA. So.
Yeah. I feel, you know, some of these fears, like I said, not all fears are rational, but they're still there. And,
okay.
But again, the patient would have to be within the limits of the program, have talked to a doctor and been recommended by their doctor that this would be helpful for them. Just like the current law, the current okay. affirmative defense says, you have to be within the limits of the program to claim that defense.
Why would they not then apply for a card?
Well, again, say my job is I work.
I don't know that. I personally, I don't. I'm not going to go there. I mean, I think if a person qualifies,
but this
and,
is the argument that's been out there.
Well, you know, I think we have to make it. Okay, there it has been suggested that naturopaths and others, nurse assist,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
and.
Nurse practitioners and others, I don't disagree with that. Mm-hmm. That's something that we didn't address, but I think that there has to be a clear, bright line in terms mm-hmm. of either you are or you're not.
And
if you are, then you better have a card.
Mm-hmm.
And if the card can't get there in a timely fashion, you keep your application and affirmative defense will bail you out. But I think there's got to be that line that you're either in the program or you're out of the program. Now, there is a bill coming over from the House. I don't know when or how mm-hmm. or what will happen that allows an employer to hire, you know, discharge a person.
In fact, that was our bill on the House side.
Okay, well, that's going to be interesting because a person who does have a card and has the legitimate use of mm-hmm. medicine that society under other circumstances would not approve can mm-hmm. be fired if it's detected. Now, that raises the whole question, which we haven't dealt with even. Also, is
I don't think, Mr. Chair, I think that's dealing with if the performance of their job, they would be a danger to themselves or others.
Yeah.
It's not.
No.
It's
well,
not.
That raises the question of when was the, did they use the marijuana before they came to work? And it's a judgment. Someone has to make a value judgment.
Actually, that decision was decided in the courts.
Okay.
What happened is that originally was tried in Portland, and I believe the original case it went against the patient or whatever that was in the program and said he could be fired for being in the program. It went to the appellate court, and at that point they overruled it and said this was a violation of the Oregon Disabilities Act.
Okay.
And they had ruled that by doing that you would basically be saying if you're in this program or use medical marijuana you can't work.
Okay.
And that would be, like I said, I think that's too far stretching.
But you know, if you were using medical marijuana you might not want to be landing jets on a carrier at night.
And I would agree to sensitive job positions, hazardous job positions being.
Well, even without it I wouldn't want to do it, period.
Okay. Moving along.
And again, okay, now some of the people were suggesting when they were talking about the 7 plants, well, this is enough. Dr. Bear said that, well, 6 plants is enough for an experienced grower, but for the, you know, inexperienced novice who's just starting, that 6 plants would not be enough. Well, my answer to that is don't raise the plant limit. Teach the patients how to grow. You know, right now, having illegal growers, they said the reason that they can't have background checks is because the people that know how to grow this now have probably been arrested in the past. Well, in a sense, there are many of these people that are honest and helping patients and doing good, but we are also bringing in a lot of people that are attracted to this program because they're able to abuse it. And what I see is instead of having the black market be responsible for teaching our patients and our caregivers how to do this within the limits of the law, turn this over to the Oregon Extension Office, whose job it is to teach people how to grow plants.
Master Gardener Program.
Right.
I thought of that.
No,
you did. But I was thinking if we established a center of growth site, it would be through an institution that would involve some of the extension people, the Master Gardener people in that program. Now, that's an interesting point. Could we fashion the extension program to accommodate?
Now, I talked to the person in Marion County, and he already told me, the head chief master gardener for Marion County's program says, it's a legal plan in Oregon. If we have the mandate, we can do this.
That's an interesting point, and I think that's something we should look at.
And also, to another point that we had brought up in the past, which was the registration manual in plain, clear, easy to read, understand text, just like the driver's license manual you have when you try to get, it's a book this thick that lists basically every possibility or every situation you could encounter and how that is to be handled or under the law. And I think the same type of situation for the medical marijuana manual, so patients aren't trying to read legalese and legislative language, which is difficult for lawyers, let alone the average patient. And again, a lot of the problems in this program is people have been misled. They've been told things that aren't true. They're following somebody who doesn't have their interest at heart, basically their information, and it's gotten a lot of people in trouble.
Okay, now, what's the procedure currently for a new patient? In terms of, you go to the doctor gives you a letter, you send that in, you get your card. Is there any, there's no one here from public health, do they provide any kind of instruction?
They provide a packet when you first apply, which comes with you, which is a copy of the ORS.
Yeah.
And they give you a letter, which is frequently asked questions. I don't have a copy, but I've sent it to you. And basically, the frequently asked questions all say, we can't answer your question.
Okay. Kind of like the IRS then.
Yeah.
Okay. So what you're saying is that currently we do not have an adequate manual instruction that goes into any detail, which is also a reason to keep some of the money that we have in the fee reserve to provide that kind of information. And I am very disturbed that money has been confiscated.
And again,
the money the director stole?
Yes. Okay. Well, it wasn't the director.
Oh, yes.
And my last part that I do strongly support is creating very stiff penalties for caregivers that steal patients' medicine or abuse this person. And I do not believe anybody should ever be barred or blocked from becoming a patient in this program. Anybody can become disabled. But as far as a caregiver, that's a different card. That's a privilege. That's something you have no
medical... Now, caregiver, you're talking about the grower,
the
right?
The grower.
Okay.
And on that situation, if a grower is convicted of delivery of marijuana to a non-card holder or selling marijuana to anyone, I believe, as Craig Durbin has laid out, the first offense should be 7 years out of the program as far as a caregiver. If he hits by a truck next week and becomes a patient, he can register as a patient.
Okay, so you're not talking retroactive elimination from the program like
forward-looking.
And in fact, the part about ID checks or background checks for patients, I would support very strongly. Again, like I said, if you're
patient
in the program, registered in the program, or a caregiver, already in the program, and you're arrested for breaking the law, you should know the law. You know you're breaking the law, and it should violate you from being a caregiver and harming or stealing another patient's medicine.
Yeah,
because if you're selling it, you're selling something that doesn't belong to you.
Well, okay. Okay, so, that sounds reasonable.
Okay.
But those are pretty, and as far as the other provisions in the thing, we strongly support the WERCEDA. And again, I would like to thank you and the members of this panel. There are a lot of politicians that would have shied away or not handled a medical marijuana bill for political reasons. And yet you guys have championed a bill that is working to help the patients in this program, and I really commend you for it.
Self-flagellation.
Thank you.
We enjoy pain, right?
For several sessions now, sir.
Yes. Okay. Michael.
It's late.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate all the input. There's a lot needs to be done to this bill, but at the same token, I don't think it's that far away.
We're close. I think we really are.
I mean, I don't think it's that far away, so.
Okay.
Thank you.
You've got to be optimistic.
Oh, I am. Close the work session. Meeting adjourned.